leen di xaw ci on in Mamelodi. My point of departure really is the 1994 covenant that we had in this country. We established a constitutional democracy. The constitution, which is now the supreme law, should be illuminating our path in our diversity, a diverse society that we are, a pluralistic society which seeks to achieve that pluralistic solidarity. Now, for a constitutional democracy to thrive, to be successful, this was a great idea to have, amongst others, in cognizance with the doctrine of the separation of powers, to have institutions like the Human Rights Commission, the Chapter 9 institutions. So the Human Rights Commission is one of those very important bodies which support, as an institution that supports a constitutional democracy in our country. I think I consider myself to be a suitable candidate going into my qualifications, the qualities that I possess. I have worked for government after many years of being an activist. I worked in the State Department's Land Affairs and Justice, dealing with land reform and specifically restitution. In the Department of Justice, I went there to be specifically the project manager for the launch, the implementation of the equality legislation. The equality legislation, it's launching first the prevention, the prohibition part of that legislation, the establishment of equality courts, working with these institutions like the human rights, have played that pivotal role. It's been a keen interest in me, the human rights, constitutional, administrative, labor law area, even from my studies. So going back to my days of involvement and then thereafter taking up, pursuing my studies to get qualifications and then working in this area from land reform and then constitutional matters and specifically the equality program, as I say, I think that I would be an appropriate candidate to deal with this, because when you look at those objectives, when you look at the functions, the duties of what are entailed in what the Human Rights Commission should be doing, I have had an opportunity to play many of those: education, public campaigns, explication of the law to ordinary people, bringing the constitutional language in the idiom of the people. There's still a long way to go, I agree, but I consider myself better suited. I think I would be able to do that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, with the permission of Mr. Schwartz, I would be asking his question. We have asked this question to all the candidates, and this question varies enormously on who is asking it. So I'm going to give to this question my own slant, if you wish. And I warn you against my slant, because I'm by no far the most popular or the most powerful member of this committee.
Yes.
But the question is, how do you, I think there is no doubt that you are qualified for the position. So we ask questions to other candidates looking at their qualification. So the question is, how do you see the position of the commission vis-à-vis the executive and the legislative branches of government, and what direction you would give if you were a commissioner? And then against a debate that we have been having with the various candidates here, and here I'm giving my own slant, where the commission has positioned itself in an advisory role somehow, working with the government, helping government along, but not taking an antagonistic role and not moving ahead of government, sometimes making difficult statements, taking difficult decisions or even taking the government to court. And the perception that one has gained is that in the mind of many people involved in the commission work, the constituents of the commission are the organs of government who need to be helped to move into a human rights culture, which undoubtedly are. But the question is to which extent the constituency of the commission also consists of the actual people. Because in respect of critical rights, the relief that was sought from the inefficient, insufficient or breaching action of government did not come through the commission, but through the action of NGOs, the TSC, Lawyers for Human Rights, or people who went to court and forced government to change its ways when other means did not take place. So what type of commissioner would you be within this debate?
My understanding of the role of the commission, the way the commission should be moving, is that it is a state institution in a constitutional democracy. It is not part of government. The commission should be independent. It should be the way when you look at the Chapter 8 of the Constitution with the courts, the judiciary, it should be complementary in that manner. The commission should break ground, and the powers are envisaged in the Commission Act and the Constitution that the commission could actually be taking action pertaining to adjudicating litigation and monitoring. So the organs of the state, other organs of state and governmental institutions are obliged to really give that assistance. It's mandatory constitutionally for them to do so. So the commission, yes, it doesn't mean that deliberately it has to adopt an adversarial posture simply because it is government, but there was a clear purpose and a fundamental one as to why we are having these institutions, why we are having courts, why we have these institutions that support democracy, because we have come with this constitution, which is really a sophisticated one, for us to suffuse our law and also engender that culture of human rights in the country. The constituents, the sectors that need to be considered as the stakeholders of things, largely the populace, individual capacity, organizational formation, civil society and the like, and the role that it has to play, the interface with the governmental institution, I think that is well encapsulated in the legislation. But we need a bold, courageous position from, but we need where it is necessary to be working and supporting government and even assisting, because when we say the culture of human rights should be engendered, the government components are not insulated. I know for experience that there's also still a long way to go there in instilling that culture of human rights even within the government. So I do see a clear role there.
I think okay. That's also. Therefore, that, Jim?
I agree with Dr. Amartini that you are qualified, is beyond doubt. Let me just ask a few factual questions and then one other. Why did you leave the Department of Justice in August of...
Yeah.
Was it last year or was it
2007. Yes, but the environment there was toxic. In the department, it's stifling, stultifying, and so on. So I needed to have this growth. I don't want to dwell much on this, but I want to say to you, we still have some way to go in realizing the objectives, the principles set out in Chapter 10 of the Constitution of the public service.
Okay, thank you. And
yeah.
then was August 2007.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Then I'm very interested in your references, which include very interesting people, ranging from my old friend, Haukelo
Lekoro, yes.
Judge Dennis Davis, Professor Jonathan Clarence,
yes.
And an engineering professor from UCT. And I was curious, without going into too great a depth, but clearly this reflects a pattern like you'll give me when you answer in a minute, an idea from how you know all of them. The main thing I want to ask is, it's wonderfully useful that you ran the Equality Review project.
Yes.
And would you please just give us a sense of how well you think it is working? Most people say no, there aren't enough equality court cases yet.
Yeah.
But is that true? And what else needs to be done by the Human Rights Commission about the Equality Act at the court?
That's right. Okay, as far as the referees are concerned, yeah, people like the MEC for Housing and Local Government in Gauteng, Haukelo Lekoro, we grew up together in the Pretoria area as activists in the UDF and so on. We worked together there, and he's known me for all the things that I have tried there to outline my background. Him and people like Begin Gosi and Titus Mafole could say a lot about me. We were all, and the ambassador in Bonn, Mr. Moshigane, who was really my mentor. So we used to work with people like Minister Manuel, Terra Ligota, and so on. So the Pretoria area, that is where our activities lately. So he's in that regard, he could. And Professor Dennis Davis, apart from him being my teacher at Wits, and also we've had a lot of exchanges, taught me tax law and jurisprudence and insurance law, but especially on constitutionalism, on human rights, and on socio-political issues. So I was involved with a person like Judge, the one on the Labour Court Judge. Yeah, he knows my role in land affairs, in negotiations, in the settlement of claims. He used to play a role of a mediator there with many, many state land owners like the police and so on. And then Professor Bennett was my warden at UCT, where I studied for my first degree, and I was leader, sub-warden first as the head student and the leader of the students there. So the mediation, the negotiation, the conciliation has all along been my approach in life to resolve problems among people. So that is how I... So he's an engineering professor, but he was a warden there. The Equality Project, the launching, the implementation of the legislation, the launching of the court, the training of judicial officers, all those things went well. And then in the earlier part, it started to get, in my view, where it's lacking is the public education, the public awareness campaigns. I really think that the Human Rights Commission could work in tandem or assist or play a complementary role. But for me, it's not even complementary, because the Human Rights Commission does deal directly with the equality legislation, and the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So it's one of those. I think they could work. When we were there, kick-starting the awareness campaign, We used to work a lot with the Human Rights Commission people, the current CEO and the past chairperson, Jody Colapen, and others here. So, but I really think that they need dedicated people to work on that, to popularize this act and to do the education among people here, and to make people aware about the cases which have been decided. Because, and also, yes, as I say, the education is critical in a sense that inequality, unlike the other pieces of legislation that we dealt with, people were sort of need-driven. We talk about maintenance and the like, there is that need in social security issues. Inequality, that's not an easy concept when you talk about substantive equality. You really have to work how to make it comprehensive, to be be grasped by ordinary people in the crowd. But it needs a lot of dedication. It doesn't need a lot of staff turnover. So they need to really organize the structures in the department to work on that.
Thank you very much. Prof?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. My apologies for coming late. I'm taking a walk to my office. Your wealth of experience is astounding. I'm particularly impressed by your involvement in land affairs, which pose a great challenge to the disadvantaged. Now, the question is, should you be appointed, what will you do to apply human rights to land reform and to protect farm workers and laborers from being abused and victimized on a daily basis? The second question, what will you do if appointed to monitor the observance of human rights generally in South Africa?
Thank you, Professor Ndabandaba. Because we are in a rights-based society, we already have the necessary legislative instruments, and they all flow from the Constitution. What we need really is the implementation, is for us to be there on the ground. And we need to use the very approach which we have in our in many new generation equity pieces of legislation, where sensitizing, educating, mediating, and conciliation is the key among all stakeholders. So you would have also to bring this to the attention of the farming community to say we are South Africans, we play different roles, you've got an important role to play in the community, in the economy of South Africa, but now we live in the society where fundamentally the rights of the people have got to be respected. We're not going to do anything that is contained in the law, enshrined in the Constitution, but we need to foster and engender that spirit to say that as South Africans, as all people who are aspiring for progress, for prosperity, we need to cooperate. That kind of consciousness will have to be brought to bear among all peoples, including the farmers. And if all fails, that is the last resort where we bring sanctions, but sanctions which we hope that will also play, will work as corrective measures to whoever is involved. But we cannot abandon the constitutional project. Yes, we cannot. We are just obliged to push our rights philosophy to ensure that the foundational principles of our constitution are honored: quality, dignity, and freedom. So we will have to really intervene and work on those. So, working with the ground, there is no finite date, there is no fixed time, it is forever, long after you and I are gone, to have to cultivate this thing of a human rights culture. But we must bequeath upon the next generations. We should be able to say with pride that this is how far we have gone, and you should take it further. And we should see noticeable and tangible progress as we go forward. It is the human rights culture that has to be learned. It is the fundamental rights that have got to be known throughout the country. And they're not going to happen of themselves. So we've got to take a leading role as leaders, as commissioners, play that leading role, look at all sectors and make sure that that comes about. You spoke about the land. Yes, the understanding of how the land reform programs work, I think it is vital to know very well and to know even the applicable pieces of legislation. You take an example of the restitution itself. That is a rights-based it's a constitutionally mandated right to say this should be happening. I think to a very large extent, even the farmers know about that. They are aware of a program like restitution, and they get edgy about the uncertainty. There should be movement on the part of the commission and the department that do that. And sometimes they are hamstrung by the resources. I know for a fact that there are claims which are hanging there because of budgetary constraints. So they've got to be pushed through. I'm confident that the systems, the policies are there. It's just for us to put a shoulder on the wheel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Scudder. Any other questions? Well, we are happy as a panel. Thank you very much for presenting to us. Let me ask you a question. What if you had to be appointed, would you be full-time or part-time?
Full-time.
You would want to be full-time?
I would want to be full-time, yes.
No, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. You are a blessed.
Thank you, Advocate Roman Cody.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, I'm not getting my food. I'm not getting my food. And that 6 months, he kept
Yes, there's no other mystery questions.
there's a couple of things that I'm asking you. So, but then I'm asking you how to send the picture. You know, I actually want to send them anymore. I mean, just basically, I'm looking for like a list of preferred electronics of the course. Of the office manager or business brother or problem number, and if I can have their email address as well. But I'm sure there must be a comprehensive list from the department, or if that department has that school. I think there is a question for this. Because I asked my secretary to compile this to me, but it's not really that word.
I'm going to be able to
ask for that. Do you think we should call them?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, I'll call them later.
Okay. You want a list of somebody who comes to us, the register of the returns of the high school, the clerk of the board is not if they possibly like an email address or
I hope it makes me remain involved in it.
Now my question was,
But my question was, what difference is that now? You know, you can call the name of the parliament closer to the people, but wasn't that the whole aim of the constituency office now? Well, because there are still parts of offices and it's also going to create unnecessary problems, you know, and to who is the one assigned to the owner, half the time, all those kind of issues, and then she also, well, I came to the conclusion that nothing is about constituency offices, and we are just do what you would like to do, and hope that you're not putting in people to which I'm taking to them too. But I don't understand, because I mean, Parliament has been in existence in the late 1994, for over 30 years, and why is it, you know, the way it is now? But it seems like that there's this attitude that everybody just knows what you know, and you don't really know what to do if your party is about you. But it doesn't mean that the party is following the right route, you know, and it's more that you have to be money involved, and you have to be, you will be always responsible for the party. You know, so for me, that is a major problem.
No, it's for the reason. Members of the committee are displayed prominently in front of each and everyone. What we ask of you now is to give us a very brief summary of why you think you should be considered for the Human Rights Commission and make reference to relevant experience. What energy strength would you think you'd bring to the commission if appointed? After that, we will ask the members to ask you questions, and I would want you to be very precise, to the point, not over elaborate. And if I feel you are over elaborating, I'll intervene. And if you'd relax, not feel intimidated by my interventions. So, there we go. Well, we can thank you.
To put it on, Chairman? Or you put it on?
Yeah, please, yeah, it's on. Once
thank you, Chairman, and the honorable members of the panel. My name is Wallace Mkoti. I trained initially as a lawyer. I'm pregnant for as a social worker. And then later, when I wanted to become more effective in what I was doing, I decided to go and study law, and I did so at UCT. And even after that, I wanted to not practice traditional law, but move into public interest law. And for that reason, after I graduated with an LLB at UCT, then in 1985, I applied to the Legal Resources Center to do a fellowship program in public interest law. And then I went to do my articles, and after that, I went back to the LRC when I was admitted as an attorney to practice public interest law, because I felt at that time that this was much, you know, needed, you know, in the country, to be in a position to help large masses of people in our country in terms of the kind of problems that we were facing at the time. And I continued to practice from 1988 after my admission until 1995. In 1995, I was then appointed to the Land Restitution Commission. And also there, it was, you know, a form of promoting, you know, human rights in this country, you know, through that particular work. So, Chairman, I would like to say that I am eminently, you know, qualified to be considered for a position in the Human Rights Commission. As a matter of fact, my history dates back even earlier than I have just, you know, sketched out, you know, from the time I was even a final year student. At 1994, I participated in the Law and Poverty, a group of the Carnegie Inquiry into Poverty at the time. And I would like to just pause this.
Mr. Gorski, it's nice to have you here. Welcome, and feel at home. May I ask you one or two questions in general about the how you see the relationship of the commission should you be appointed as a commission now? How you would see that relationship with the different legs of government? Firstly, the executive, and secondly, parliament. In particularly in view of the Chapter 9 report, this ad hoc committee's report, that highlighted some of the weaknesses. Whilst the Commission has done a lot of good work, some of the weaknesses relate to reporting from the departments on the promotion of socioeconomic rights, the dealing of complaints from the executive side, and also the issue of how the Commission relates to Parliament. How would you see that? Should you be appointed as a Commissioner? How would you improve that situation in view of the powers of the Commission, number one?
Yes.
And secondly, just the issue of whether you've got any conflicts of interest, should you be appointed as a Commissioner, whether you proceed, whether there's anything we need to know about your background, whether there's any issues of integrity that we need to know that might not be in your profile, but particularly on those issues.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Well, my understanding of the structure and the functions of the Human Rights Commission, which are, you know, predicated upon the Constitution, is that, in fact, like all 39, you know, institutions, these institutions are preeminently meant to be, you know, independent and completely, you know, impartial in the execution of the functions. And these are outlined both in the Constitution as well as in the, you know, founding, you know, Act, and in this case, the Human Rights Commission Act. And I would say that one, because in a sense, for the integrity of the institution, it's quite important for those institutions to be seen to be, above the run of the mill kind of issues, and be seen and be perceived and be experienced even, you know, by people on the ground, to be a totally impartial. And I would say that from, you know, my own training and professional life, I mean, I understand, you know, that quite sharply. And I think my record, I mean, I think stands for itself in terms of, you know, those particular issues. I mean, especially one's involvement, for example, in government, even post-1994, I mean, in the Land Restriction Commission, I mean, I think my record stands, you know, quite clearly. And happily, I was involved there from a very founding of that institution to the point where I became, you know, after Mr. Saramani, the Chief Land Claims Commissioner, and in a sense, the chairman of, you know, that commission until 2003. So I am fairly aligned to the imperatives, you know, that drive the second institutions, and in particular, the Human Rights Commission. And I would, you know, strive, you know, to maintain those, you know, principles and those standards. And also make sure that, you know, because in essence, this institution that is accountable to, you know, to Parliament, I'll make sure that, those things, you know, are actually done, you know, properly. I haven't had sight of that particular report, but I've been looking at other, you know, documents relating to, the work of the Commission, for example, their strategic plan for the next, I think, 3 years. And I certainly, you know, identified a number of, you know, gaps, which I think would need to be filled. And I saw room, you know, for improvement. And I don't think anyone running, I mean, that is not in any way meant to cast, you know, aspersions to my predecessors in the Commission. But I think I bring a wealth of, you know, experience also from governance of non-governmental organizations, you know, as well as being in government itself. And as to whether, I mean, I have any, you know, conflict of interest, I'm not aware of those, other than what I have, you know, disclosed in my biographical information that I've made available to you.
Thank you, Doctor. My name is Dean Fatah. I represent the Democratic Alliance as an MP. And I need to ask you certain questions which will relate to the DA. You've just assured us of your commitment to impartiality, and yet when you were an officer of one of the other Chapter 9 institutions, the IEC, in 2006, you were fired as the Cape Town Electoral Officer, the Cape Metro Electoral Officer, because you published an article in the Cape Times that I understand is attacking one of the parties participating in that election, which was my party. And then secondly, on the matter of impartiality, I understand that you sent a letter to the IEC in your capacity as city manager, declaring two vacancies in one of the partner parties to the multi-party coalition in Cape Town, when in fact that was not your function, and it was in fact the speaker's function. And that letter has been described in various very unkind terms, and Helen Zimmer at the time accused you of trying to bring down an elected multi-party council. That's on the matter of impartiality. We need to hear you on that. On the matter of fitness and propriety for this office, I think it goes without saying that a human rights commissioner must be above reproach, and therefore I would like to ask you to address us on some of the really contentious issues to which your name has been attached. One was the Jewelry City project, under which you are said to have illegally signed off an 8 million contract for the Jewellery City project to a friend, as you said, without proper tender processes, and nothing came of it because of the fact that the process was not in fact followed. Then there was the Big Bay matter, where Mr. Tokyo Sekwale, currently our Minister of Human Settlement, got a 36 million rand discount for being disadvantaged and got prime land in Big Bay. That tender was scrapped altogether after the issue blew up. So those were highly contentious and controversial. And one last heading, one of the functions of the Human Rights Commission is to oversee progress of socio-economic rights, which would include housing, and yet there again you have been involved with some contentious issues, including the overseeing of the N2 Gateway project. So you would need, I think, to address us on those three scores.
Mm-hmm.
How well could you function on socio-economic rights, including housing, when there is that still hanging and not completed, impartiality, and the matter of being above reproach?
Yeah.
Last president. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Dennis Mark. Firstly, I was the full-time officer of the IEC. You know, I was the city manager, and I really do recall, you know, something of a letter that was brought to my attention for submission, you know, to the IEC. I did, you know, sign, you know, such a letter, and. And acting, you know, completely, you know, bona fide. I mean, I know that there's been a lot of malafides, you know, attributed, you know, by the aggrieved, you know, party, you know, in respect of that particular matter. And I think it's that matter was never, you know, adjudicated upon and, you know, be finalized in any, you know, fair and open way. So, I mean, I think you would take a view on that in as much as I take a view as to what happened there. And on the matter of, if I could just... yes, I think I acted completely, you know, bona fide, I mean, in that particular matter. There would be, of course, you know, the other side of the, you know, there would be in any case, in any, you know, dispute. On the matter of the African Jewellery City, of course, Chairman, I do want to say that I wouldn't want to go into the merits of that, because that matter is a matter that's pending before a court of law. Safe to say that insofar as we were concerned, we were selling a very innovative you know, project, and again, as a city manager, was acting completely bona fide. And the fact that, you know, I can just say that for example, we had designed that process to be a two-phase process. The phase one was going to be a closed process because this was a new sort of idea that was brought in. And then the second phase was going to be an open tender process. And it was done on the basis that whatever cost that we incurred in the first phase would be refundable to the municipality upon the closing of that, you know, adjudication process. And it went to the point where, in fact, the successful, two successful bidders, haven't there been black, you know, companies, or BE companies, actually signed an undertaking, you know, to refund the municipality of 8 million. And, of course, the municipality, having been taken over, decided, in fact, not to go ahead with that. And so clearly, I mean, there was... And I would even go as far as saying that if that arrangement had been honored or was honored today, the municipality would receive its 8 million rand, you know, tomorrow, you know, from in fact, they even went to as far as disputing a court action against the non-enforcement of that particular arrangement. I wouldn't want to go, you know, deep into the matter because this is a defendant matter before the High Court and. We have, you know, we have an opportunity in a court of law to actually disclose fully, you know, our defense in the matter. I wouldn't want to take it that far. And that on the Big Bay thing, I mean, again, I think this is a very sort of fairly wild and general, you know, statements and allegations about the fact that Mr. Tompkins Kwale's company was, you know, favored with a discount of $36 million. I don't think I should, in all fairness, you know, be put on the carpet for something. Because again, there I was, you know, exercising, and I do, you know, at all material times, exercise my mind on these matters. And I never, can never be said that I acted honestly, I acted without integrity.
No,
that cannot be said. On the N2 Gateway project, again, I know that there are some problems there, but again, you know, as an accounting officer, I know that one, you know, is held liable for this matter. There certainly were problems that if I had been aware of myself, you know, I would have, you know, decided, you know differently. And you would also be aware that the documentation everything in this matter is prepared by, you know, law officials. And if they mislead you in any way, you end up, you know, carrying the can. And again, that matter also, I want to still, you know, receive fairly detailed and specific allegations as to what it is that is attributable to me, and in a way that says I did not act with integrity, and I did not act with, you know, in a manner that is above reproach. And secondly, there are lessons that I have learned, you know, in serving in a fairly senior position. And those lessons I will certainly take with me into, you know, the next phase of my life. Thank you.
Unless I missed it, did I miss the answer to the fact that you are said to have been fired as the electoral officer by the thing because you published an
article? No, I was not. I really, I'm not aware of that. I mean, I was hearing for the first time. I was not fired for the IEC.
You were an electoral officer.
No, you know, I think there was, because my term was coming to an end or something, you know, that's how I stepped down. I was never fired by the IEC. I mean, because it seems to be tied to that. I don't know if I was right, I see.
There
were so many articles that, you know, are published. I don't think there was an article where, for example, I had made, because I was attacked personally, you know, and in a sense, in association, in being associated, it was also being said that I'm not acting as an official, but I'm acting as an ANC politician. And I did, of course, write an article that was comparing what had happened in the period prior, which was at the time that the DA was running the city, and what we had been able, you know, to achieve over the three-year period that I was there. And, of course, some people took umbrage, you know, to that, and took it as but it was, in a sense, a direct, you know, reply to statements that were made, you know, about poor, you know, governance, which is not the case. And I refuted that. And of course, as an official, I was, you know, lambasted, you know, for that.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Dr. Mgog, that's how it's pronounced in Zulu.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Gog. With your wealth of experience and background, which is extremely impressive, what do you think are the most pressing challenges facing the Human Rights Commission and the culture of human rights in South Africa? That's the first question. Now, the second question is, Dr. Mgogri, in our view as a panel, we think that the Human Rights Commission is 24 hours work, not 84. Now, which implies that most of the time you will be under extreme pressure. How would you handle that pressure without getting off balance? Those are my two questions.
Thank you, sir. Certainly the challenges that face the Human Rights Commission, I think are fairly, you know, wide and broad. And in my examination of the situation, I still think that the task or challenge of making the human rights culture to be embedded in the psyche of the nation is the most preeminent, you know, challenge. And it's not something that is done overnight. And I think credit must be given to the efforts that have been made, you know, this far. But I don't think, in fairness, it can be said that those efforts are adequate, because we wouldn't be experiencing the kinds of levels of violation of human rights as we do experience, you know, in our country today. So it's going to take quite an empathic, you know, approach and strengthening of what has been, you know, done so far. And I really wouldn't come in and act like a bull in a china shop, you know, in this you know, arrangement. Make a fair assessment, scan, you know, the environment insofar as the HRC, I mean, has done so far, and fill, you know, the gaps. And especially because I was, one of the things I was looking at was the emphasis on, you know, a national approach and a provincial approach. And I think I saw immediately a gap in terms of, you know, targeting local government, you know, institutions. Because that's where, in a sense, people interface with government, you know, in a real sense. And I haven't been seeing a focus, you know, in that area. And for me, that was an area that I would immediately move into. There are about 284 municipalities in this country. And they are the ones that people, when you talk about government, they will relate to the local, you know, office of the municipality and what it does. And that would be an area, you know, of focus. Because highlighting that and embedding, you know, in ways that are understandable to people would be a way of meeting that particular challenge. And to a point where the psyche of ordinary people, you know, including those who violate human rights, is completely transformed and changed to a point where people respect, you know, other human rights. That's the main area. And another challenge that certainly been looking at is you know, structuring the functioning of, especially those, I mean, I was seeing less of the an actual articulation of what the commission are responsible for, you know, other than, you know, the members of staff. And I would want that you know, certainly brought, I mean, made to surface much more, so that there is a level also of accountability on the part of people who are commissioners. They know what it is that is expected of them, and that they can be held accountable, you know, for that, including myself, you know. And and of course, now one is talking about what there are challenges, I mean, in the domestic arena, and of course, human rights is also a practice that relates to regional institutions and international institutions. There is also a lot of, you know, work there.
Thank you. Yeah. Prof, do you have another question?
Relating to where, I mean, how I would cope with the pressure, as a matter of fact, even in my private life, just because of the kind of profile one has had, I have had to embark in work of this nature, way beyond my own sort of calling, and it's something that is very close to my heart. I mean, if you look at my history, from early days, I have committed myself to this area of work, and I would have no problems. I would fit into it like a hand in a glove.
Thank you. Doctor, any question?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Just if I can ask a preliminary question before asking my actual question. Your resume, I'm not sure whether I'm reading it correctly. Basically, what happened after 2005 and what position do you currently hold, if any?
I left the city of Cape Town in April 2006. I was a city manager until the 10th of April 2006, when council terminated my contract. And of course, that was also a disputed matter whether or not the contract was properly terminated. And I was in litigation with the city until about November of 2006. So effectively, I didn't do anything really. And in the following year, 2007, I started legal practice, you know, in Devonville, which I ran until the end of 2008, and I closed it down. And from the beginning of this year, I have been, you know, consulting, doing general consulting work.
Are you looking for a full-time or a part-time position? And would you be willing to relocate to Johannesburg?
Yes, I'm open. I'm open for a full-time position. And yes, I would be willing to relocate to. I mean, it would not be for the first time. In my first appointment to government, I was regional commissioner, but based in Cape Town. But when I was elevated to being a national commissioner, I relocated to Pretoria. So it would not be for the first time. Thank you.
Are you performing any human rights activities currently, and more specifically in Wallenstein?
Well, I just recently, the last week, filed a report to the Wallenstein University, because I was appointed there with a colleague, Dr. Manda Sabalala, to conduct an inquiry into student grievances and all that, which I regarded and made fairly substantive recommendations on how the situation even there at university could be improved, including, in fact, a section which I wrote on putting the student world to rights, because I came to a situation where I felt student rights were not really properly recognized. And of course, the concept of rights is responsibilities. I also, you know, because I sense that students themselves were somewhat not observing their own responsibilities. I also wrote a section on responsibility. As regards what has been not specific work, I mean, I have been assisting, you know, groups of people because I'm like regarded as some kind of unofficial mayor, you know, there. And I have been linking people, for example, setting up trusts for people who are working, for example, in the nearby farm there, Jube China, something. You know, helping them, you know, to participate, you know, because the employer, the owner of that farm, wanted to, you know, give people a stake. So it's the kind of work that comes natural to me. The fact that, I mean, even last year, I mean, I was involved in KwaZulu-Natal helping communities there, Sokolu, Dube, and it was precisely because of that kind of orientation and the natural, you know, inclination to promote human rights, you know, wherever I see the need. So doing it in an official capacity would be something that I would take quite seriously. Of course, working in a team and collective, you know, work, sort of spirit with other people.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Hakika, I've been trying to establish in my mind and also in your autobiographical sketch from CV as to under what circumstances you left the Land Claims Commission. The reason is because you make the point that you were doing quite well introducing methods and innovations that led to a speedier delivery of land in terms of the Restitution Act, and that you consider that you have been commendable work in this regard, there is still a lot to be done, especially with regard to the giving of assistance to land beneficiaries to use the land productively in a sustainable way. I'm wondering, why would you want to leave that kind of position, which is so fundamental to the realization of rights by people who were disposers of their land through colonialism and later apartheid. And regarding the fact that there is still a problem over the sustainable use of the land, productive use of the land by land reform beneficiaries, what is it that you would do as a commission to ensure that the people continue to enjoy their rights in terms of the land reform program by helping the state ensure that they get the necessary support?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I can just say that at the time that I left, it was after a period of about 8 years of driving the process. And I had reached a point where, you know, I felt that the process, the wheels were there and all of that. And they were capable, you know, cadre of leadership to take the process to a higher level. And indeed, I think that happened. I think Tozi, Gwanya, and his team did exactly that. And I must be honest and say that the point you're making is quite valid, that the outstanding work has always been the enabling of communities to use the land profitably, productively, and sustainably. And that has been one of my, I must say, I've been regarding it as some unfinished, you know, a business, you know, from my side. Because you will appreciate that from the very beginning, we were driving quantities. There was pressure also politically, was about how many claims are you settling this quarter, how many claims are you settling this year, how many claims are you? So we're driving quantities quite hard. And I think the side of quality somewhat, you know, suffered in the process. I've somewhat been, you know, deriving some kind of consolation, for example, from serving on the National Development Agency Board. And I can tell you now, anyone who's sitting on that organization will tell you for the first time, you know, since I came on board in 2007, the NDA has taken up quite a large chunk of land reform, you know, cases. Precisely because, I highlighted the importance of assisting with grant funding, which the NDA is about, in respect of land reform cases. And there's a lot of excitement, in fact. Most of the flagship projects you will see also in the annual report of the NDA are land reform, you know, cases. And all the things also I have been, you know, standing for has been the importance of interlinking, you know, between government institutions. I was the first person, even from the Commission's point of view, to write a memorandum that was linking the Commission of Restitution of Land Rights, linking the NDA, and linking the Land Bank. And unfortunately, this, I mean, happened just close to my exit, and that was not implemented. And when I got back to the NDA, I had, you know, been reviving those linkages. And I was certainly, from the Human Rights, you know, Commission, facilitating those linkages so that these institutions are not like acting and operating in a silo sort of way, but do find ways of interlinking, because socioeconomic rights, someone mentioned earlier, I don't think I did justice to that question. It's a question that I appreciate its importance. The working together of government institutions is quite critical, I mean, in driving programs of development and of upliftment of people. And I have like a view of a pilot insofar as that is concerned. And I have the experience, you know, of facilitating that kind of a thing to happen. So from the Human Rights Commission's point of view, I would make sure that those linkages are actually, you know, established, and that people see human rights also not just as a concept, but also in terms of the changing of the material conditions under which they are living, so that they experience human rights.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Now, follow-up. I'm sure we are all done, satisfied. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much, Doctor, for taking time to come and present to us. And good luck. We're grateful you made time to come and be with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Okay.
Thank you. Now, we can discuss tomorrow. The suggestion is to start at 9 or 10. I think the number is 1.